this session. I'm Claire Barris, and this is Mike Marquardt, and we are the early morning entertainment this morning. Mike is a great guy. He's a good guy. He's an amazing scholar. Oh, and Dan, why don't you come up? He's barely started. I'm going to turn the time over to Dan.
Oh, thank you.
Dan's our moderator. And
sorry to be so late.
No, you're fine.
Welcome to session 311. This is the last day of Sunstone for 2018. By way of announcements, the Sunstone Education Foundation is a 501c3 and depends on your generous donations. If you are in a place to do so, please consider making a contribution at the desk. You can support Sunstone by purchasing some of our conference-themed merchandise, including lanyard pins of some of Sunstone's most esteemed scholars and other prominent figures in Mormonism. Audio for this session and others throughout the conference will be available for purchase at the Sunstone AV desk, also located in the concourse. This conference has an official app. Look in your printed program for instructions on how to download the Whova app to get real-time updates for the conference, including connecting with other attendees. Okay, this presentation is titled Mormonism and the Tradition of Change. First paper, Change and Evolution in Mormonism. H. Michael Marquardt. This paper explains a variety of changes that occurred in the Mormon tradition, including some of the early revelations. Summarizing some of the more interesting changes. Understanding the changing historical record opens a door to new modes of interpretation. The second paper, Anti-Mormon Influence on the Road, or the Rod of Nature, Reevaluation. Presenter Claire Barris. The first anti-Mormon book emphasized Joseph Smith's treasure-seeking activities in New York, causing Smith to modify a revelation by removing references to a divining rod. This presentation summarizes how this book influenced the Rod of Nature revelation, DNC 8, and details the origins of the Cowdery family's use of divining rod to receive revelations. H. Michael Marquardt is an independent historian, research consultant, and editorial board member of the John Whitmer Historical Association Journal. He is the compiler of Early Patriarchal Blessings of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Later Patriarchal Blessings of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and co-author of William Shepherd of Lost Apostles, co-authored with William Shepherd. Forgotten members of Mormonism's original Quorum of 12. Claire Barris manages Today in MormonHistory.com. He has presented papers at Sunstone, the John Whitmer Historical Association, and the Mormon History Association. He blogs at withoutend.org, Mormon Chronicles, blogspot.com, and examiner.com. So, Michael.
This paper will explain some of the changes that were made in the early years of the Mormon movement. That there was evolution in what had been taught in religious classes and over the pulpit is certain. There's no need to fear about obtaining knowledge in the information age. Over 200 years ago, Joseph Smith's senior family settled in Palmyra, New York. Mormon tradition revolves around this family. 11 years later, Joseph Jr. started giving revelations to believers in the story of the plates of gold. Individuals have discovered that the story of the Latter-day Saints has changed over time. Different elements were solidified in the early church. Telling the story in a new way should assist believers and non-believers to be on the same page and alleviate arguments. We can agree to disagree and have respect for each other. What follows tries to include small and large changes based upon historical records. The stories we were told has a history all by itself. It's okay to have an alternate view of the restoration events. Religious history includes convictions which may or may not be based upon facts. Usually, individuals do not change their thinking unless presented with documentation, and that does not guarantee any change. What is important is not who had the most influence or actually made the redactions, but that they were made. We can learn from history and appreciate what it tells us about the past. It's good to know that we are ever learning and do not need to feel embarrassed by learning new ideas. Problems occur when taking Joseph Smith's official 1838-39 story as historical fact rather than as a faith account of religious significance. A helpful insight into understanding Smith is how he regarded the confusion among the churches. Joseph, by having a Palmyra revival take place before a vision, creates an indication of how this story is being told. If it is maintained that this manuscript history should be read literally, problems need to be addressed. It is a story about the angel in the Book of Mormon vision. If this occurred after the excitement of a religion in the neighborhood, which has been shown to have been ended by early 1825, that would mean that the earliest time this vision of the angel could have occurred would have been in September 1825. There would be one additional trip to the hill in September 1826, with Joseph accompanied by his wife Emma in 1827. If this is of interest that John Corll, an early member, gave a shorter time period before Joseph Smith's first introduction to the gold plates. Corll wrote and published in 1839, "The simple story as related by others was this. Sometime in the year of our Lord 1825, as nearly as I can recollect, Smith was informed by an angel that there was a valuable record concealed in the earth, and the time had now arrived for it to be brought forth and published to the world." This would fit if the vision happened after Reverend George Lane and Reverend Benjamin Stockton preached in Palmyra during the local revival. Whether the second vision happened in 1823 or 1825 may not be important, since Smith said he did not obtain the record until September 1827. The correct dating cannot be known for sure because the vision of the angel is an issue for theologians to tell in the religious saga. The manuscript history as copied in 1839 was a projection of what Smith wanted to convey to church members and the general public. If we go to earlier texts of the revelations and earlier stories, we can determine that the story of the discovery of the gold plates had different elements that were more detailed than in the telling of the official story. The manuscript history is a faith history. As such, it has the meeting of April 6, 1830, that it had been held at Mr. Peter Whitmer's senior's home in Fayette, New York, and implies that the baptisms were in that area. But the baptisms of Joseph Smith Sr. and Martin Harris were in Manchester, 25 miles away. If we looked at the history, we can know the general ideas where events took place. At church conferences in November 1831, it was decided to print revelations that Joseph Smith had received. These revelatory documents included those for the church and also to individual members of the Smith, Whitmer, and Knight families. While considering this, Sidney Rigdon made grammatical changes to the text in the manuscript volume, Book of Commandments and Revelations. Some of these changes were used, and some not, when they were selected for printing in the first church periodical, The Evening and the Morning Star, and the forthcoming Book of Commandments. Omitted documents included a revelation to sell a Book of Mormon copyright in Canada, and LDS sections 17, 51, 57, and 74. Included in the Book of Commandments were modifications of a revelation given to Oliver Cowdery that said he had another gift, which is the gift of working with the sprout, which was a divining rod he possessed. The word sprout was changed to rod. Instructions were given to preach to Native Americans, and the city of New Jerusalem would be built among the Lamanites. The word among was omitted by being crossed through and on the borders by added above the line. Questions regarding the church law were omitted. These revelatory texts were modified in the early process of publication. One interesting project was the part of the restoration was the Bible revision. The majority of the work took place between June 1830 and July 1833. This was called a new translation and was for church members. With more openness in recent years, it is easier to understand that revelatory texts, along with the founding stories, have been modified. It is no use longer to hold on to outdated views. It serves no purpose. And besides, how important are events generations ago? Many of the key documents have been altered. What one generation considers correct is said to be incorrect or disowned. Mistakes have been made and do not need to be repeated. Here are some examples of changes that were made that shows the human element at work. By May 1833, additional historical and theological redactions were being considered within the church leadership. Some issues include changing the requirements of the church's law of consecration to give all to the bishop. The early text of a February 9, 1831 revelation stressed that one was to consecrate all thy property, that which thou hast unto me, with a covenant and deed which cannot be broken. The altered portion weakened the requirement to demand only that one consecrate of thy properties, leaving the percentage all or part ambiguous. In fact, it seemed to imply that the amount might be a matter of personal preference. Changes were made by church leaders in May 1834 prior to the departure of the Camp of Israel. Zion's Camp proposed to redeem Zion in Missouri. This included changing the church's revealed name from the Church of Christ to Church of the Latter-day Saints, and by extension, the location of the April 6, 1830 meeting. Even though the church was not yet in existence 5 years, modifications were made in the revelations, first appearing in the reprint, Evening and Morning Star. By January 1835, what had been voted on at the first conference held in June 1830 and known as the Articles and Covenants of the Church were added to. This included rewording the baptismal prayer, adding priesthood offices that commence afterwards, such as bishops, high priests, high counselor, and president of the high priesthood. The publication of the 1835 Doctrine and Covenants included many alterations in the second part titled Covenants and Commandments of the Lord. The 1835 Doctrine and Covenants could be considered the first church handbook of instructions. Most church histories use the modified revelations in the 1835 Doctrine and Covenants as their base text. Included in this publication were redactions, such as additions of the biblical term Urim and Thummim, changing some of the law of the church, and combining separate revelations into one revelation. In February 1834, a church high council was established. The minutes were read, revised, and approved. A year later, the minutes were added to, including a reference to the newly appointed quorum of 12 apostles, or traveling high council. The words of an angel given as a commandment to the church about the sacrament of bread and wine were amended. What Smith was told in September 1830 was expanded into including names of biblical personages. Additional words were incorporated without regard to historical circumstances. This included the names of apostles, Peter, James, and John. Revisions like these in the early revelations were only the start of a revamp of the important story regarding Joseph Smith and the gold plates of the Book of Mormon. Early missionaries heard about an angel revealing the location of a record in the hill, not far from the Smith home. Joseph Smith talked about his experience and had it recorded in 1832. Later, Oliver Cowdery, in a series of published letters, expanded in some respects the message of the angel. Joseph Smith had an interest in the Old Testament priesthood, and to him, this fit his model well. Priesthood could control and give organization to his followers. The idea of the Melchizedek priesthood came out of his Bible revision and then into practice in early June 1831. It was then that elders received an ordination to the high priesthood after the order of Melchizedek, which was the same as the office of high priest. This was the beginning of the development of priesthood structure in the Latter-day Saint community. The evolution went beyond modifying religious texts in the story of the early years. It included what was regarded as theological ideas on the Godhead, work for the deceased, and its connection to the here and now. Joseph Smith's idea on women were patriarchal. People wanted to have a prophet to tell them what to do. It was during the Nauvoo period that Smith started telling women that he received a revelation that the order of marriage would be extended, including men being permitted to have multiple wives. When established in plural marriage, Joseph Smith required deception. This created tensions within his family, his close associates, and with the general church membership. It was saying one thing, practicing another in secret, and denying it. Smith thought he could keep his special teaching secret. He could deny any practice or teaching to those outside his inner circle. Joseph Smith had to figure a way to have women keep his involvement private. He organized a Nauvoo Relief Society and told them that they should be as Masons and learn to keep secrets. The Nauvoo Masonic Lodge was for men to keep secrets. His anointed quorum was a priesthood organization to keep their rites secret. This was extended into the Council of 50. Priesthood meant to keep the sacred teachings from others. In this way, both men and women were under the obligation of obedience. Mormonism started with Joseph Smith, the stories he repeated, the revelations he proclaimed. This included what he taught in his letters and teachings, both publicly and privately. His first revelation gave him a warning. How oft you have transgressed the commandments and laws of God and have gone on in the persuasions of men. How one reacts to learning new information is always an individual choice. Most people want to be told in the best possible way what occurred. As each branch of the Latter-day Saint movement works out their own expression of faith, it becomes harder to retain members. Is there anything to the gospel message besides quoting outdated facts? As others have said, bring on the truth, because nothing is of higher value. Thank you.
an essential component of understanding Mormonism is to understand how change has been an integral component of the Latter-day Saint tradition. At nearly every step of the way, there has been change in response to internal and external forces, which has shaped and reshaped the church. A true understanding of Mormon doctrine must include the fluid nature of doctrine, and sometimes that doctrinal change is reflected in Scripture. This paper will take a close look at a specific example of scriptural change, at an example surrounding attempts to control the narrative of Joseph Smith's early life before the church was organized, and how conflict over that story resulted in several modifications to one of the revelations published in the Doctrine and Covenants. This story has several key components occurring between 1799 up to the present. Rather than start at the beginning, I think the story is better told from the end and then working backwards towards the beginning. Last Sunday, Mormons from various branches of the Latter-day Saint tradition brought their scriptures with them to church, some versions paper and others electronic. Included is Section 8 of the Doctrine and Covenants, an early revelation about Oliver Cowdery and Revelation. Most gloss over the revelation, which on the surface seems standard fare as far as scriptures go. But a little historical background can make the text much more interesting. In Kirtland, Ohio, in 1835, Joseph Smith and his associates embarked on a project to print most of the revelations Joseph Smith had received during the past several years, encompassing his prophetic career. The revelation we call Section 8 today was published as Section 34 in the 1835 Doctrine and Covenants. The text includes two gifts for Oliver Cowdery. Oliver is told he has the gift of revelation and another gift called the gift of Aaron, which will allow him to do marvelous things. A year earlier, in 1834, events would unfold that would shape the content of the 1835 version of the Revelation. Two men, in particular, would be primarily responsible for the publication of the first anti-Mormon book, which would tell a markedly different story about Joseph Smith's early life than most Mormons had heard. A man by the name of Dr. Philastus Hurlbut converted, and that's a great name if you're looking. Dr. Philastus Hurlbut had converted to Mormonism in Ohio and soon became disaffected. He was not a doctor. His actual name was Doctor. At the behest of Ohioans unfriendly to Mormonism, Hurlbut traveled to the Palmyra area where Joseph Smith had uncovered the plates, published the Book of Mormon, and founded the church. There, Hurlbut sought more information about the origins of Mormonism, and he interviewed Joseph Smith's neighbors and acquaintances, recorded their stories into a collection of affidavits. Hurlbut returned to Kirtland and eventually handed his collection over to Eber D. Howe, the editor of the Painesville Telegraph, a newspaper in a town not far from Kirtland. Howe had been publishing articles critical of Mormonism for some time, and he compiled a book containing Hurlbut's affidavits as well as other materials Howe had collected. The book, Mormonism Unveiled, and unveiled is spelled incorrectly, V-A-I-L-E-D.
That was an accepted spelling. And,
okay, thanks for pointing that out. It was published in 1834 and created quite a sensation. Among other things, it focused on aspects of Joseph Smith's life in New York that most of the Ohio-based Mormons had never heard of. Joseph Smith and others went on a damage control mission in the surrounding area to combat the tales told in the book. Joseph also began a project that would tell his own history. a history that minimized aspects included in the affidavits collected by Hurlbut. In essence, a PR battle ensued to try to control the narrative of Joseph Smith's earlier life and character. The 1835 Doctrine and Covenants was not the first attempt to publish the revelation in question. A year before Howe's book and 2 years before the Doctrine and Covenants was first published, Latter-day Saints set up a press in Jackson County, Missouri in 1833 to publish the revelations received by Joseph Smith. But hostilities had arisen between the established Missouri settlers and the new Mormon settlers, who saw Jackson County as their religious inheritance, where they were to build a temple and a new Jerusalem where all Mormons would gather. Fears over political block voting, the abolition of slavery, and radically different religious beliefs culminated in violent opposition towards the saints. The collection of revelations called the Book of Commandments was partially printed when the printing press was destroyed by Missourians. Some copies of the nearly completed 1833 Book of Commandments were salvaged, including the revelation in question, which had been printed as chapter 34. That version of the revelation has some rather remarkable differences when compared to the 1835 Doctrine and Covenants. For example, in verse 6, rather than describing Oliver Cowdery's gift as the gift of Aaron, as it was called instead, the gift of working with the rod. And in verse 7, the gift of Aaron is called the rod of nature. The term rod of nature was a term used to describe a rod in treasure seeking or searching for buried items. And the phrase gift of working with the rod suggests Oliver was an accomplished rodsman or diviner. The implication is that Oliver Cowdery's rod was either used for treasure seeking or was considered to have similar powers or properties as a treasure seeking rod, also called a divining rod. What happened between 1833 and 1835 to cause Joseph Smith to modify the revelation, to change references from a treasure seeking device to the more biblical term gift of Aaron? In early April 1829, Oliver first met Joseph Smith and began acting as a scribe while Joseph dictated the content of the Book of Mormon. Later that month, Joseph Smith received revelations suggesting that Oliver could translate like Joseph Smith. In particular, D&C 6 and 8 discuss Oliver's gift, and that soon could be used for translating. John Whitmer made a copy of the revelation in 1831, the earliest version we have, which has differences from the 1833 Book of Commandments. Sprout is also a term used in reference to divining rods, and the term is also found in a Masonic ritual that reenacts the recovery and use of Aaron's rod from the Ark of the Covenant. And that's a very fascinating story that we don't have time to go into, but I think there's a lot of interesting information with this Masonic connection. The revelation recognizes his thing of nature as a gift from God, that God had spoken through it to Oliver before he had ever met Joseph Smith. Other revelations given around the time indicate Oliver would receive the gift of translation just as Joseph Smith had, and it seems to indicate that he would use the rod as a vehicle through which that translation would occur, just as Joseph Smith's seer stone was being used to translate. So also may Oliver Cowdery's rod be used for translation. According to affidavits collected by Dr. Philastus Hurlbut and published in Eber D. Howe's Mormonism Unveiled, when the Smith family first moved to the Palmyra area in 1816, Joseph Smith Sr. was involved in using a divining rod. And later, while digging a well with a neighbor, a seer stone was found, which Joseph Smith Jr. began to use as a seer. When we hear the phrase prophet, seer, and revelator, the seer part has to do with the ability to see through a seer stone. Joseph Smith said he, quote, could see in his stone anything he wished, close quote. Joseph Smith soon developed a reputation as an accomplished treasure seer in the area and began participating in money-digging ventures. Treasure seekers believed that buried treasure were often enchanted, having a guardian spirit that protected the treasure. According to the affidavits, Joseph Smith would place his seer stone in his hat to see the treasure location and the status of the guardian spirit. He would direct rituals and give directions to diggers, hoping to overpower or control the spirit that protected the treasure. One of Hurlbut's affidavits notes, quote, a spirit had appeared to Joseph Smith in a vision and informed him that at a certain place there would be a record on plates of gold and that he was the person that must obtain them. And he must do this in the following manner. On the 22nd of September, he must repair to the place where was deposited this manuscript, dressed in black clothes, riding a black horse with a switch tail, and demand the book in a certain name. And after obtaining it, he must go directly away and neither lay it down nor look behind him. He saw the box. He saw in the box something like a toad, which assumed the appearance of a man and struck him on the side of the head. And let me note here, you may be thinking Hoffman, the salamander letter, but this is not a Hoffman forgery. Hoffman used this story to help him build his salamander story. So this is authentic and was kind of inspiration and material for Hoffman to use. He saw in the box something like a toad, which soon assumed the appearance of a man, and it struck him on the side of the head. Again, he stooped down and strove to take the book when the spirit struck him again and knocked him 3 or 4 rods. Joseph was told to come the next year with his brother Alvin, but Alvin passed away, and the following year he was told to bring a man whom Joseph thought to be another treasure seeker, with whom he brought to the hill. Eventually, Joseph recovered the plates and would go on to translate them with his seer stone. Oliver Cowdery's father, William Cowdery, appears to have been part of a group in Vermont in the late 1790s and early 1800s called the New Israelites. And think about this phrase, New Israelites, and compare it with Latter-day Saints. Right? There's a similarity there. The New Israelites, who were intent on restoring primitive Christianity, who used their rods to receive revelation. They believed the gathering of Israel would occur in America, and they made plans to establish a new Jerusalem in Vermont, which would have the streets paved with gold that they had collected with their divining rods. Similar to patriarchal blessings, they would determine their Israelite tribal lineage through their rods, and the new Israelites used rods to receive their own revelations. Their leader, Nathaniel Wood, received a revelation through his rod directing the building of a temple. And I might point out that, as far as I'm aware, the only temple building groups in up to 1835 were the Masons, who had a symbolic temple with their lodges, the New Israelites, and then, of course, the Mormons. If anybody's aware of any other temple builders in America, I would like to know. Please let me know. So Nathaniel Wood received a revelation through his rod directing the building of a temple. He also prophesied a date of apocalyptic destruction. Tensions escalated between this group and the local residents on the night of the predicted apocalypse. The locals mobilized a militia, and before the evening was over, shots had been fired. The episode became known as the Wood Scrape. Another prophecy rescheduled the apocalypse, which also failed to occur, and the movement eventually ended. William Cowdery was probably a participant in this movement, and he may have passed on his unique practice of receiving revelations through a divining rod to his son Oliver. Shortly after Oliver first met Joseph Smith, Smith dictated DNC 8, which told Oliver that his rod had, quote, told you things. Behold, there's no other power save God that can cause this rod of nature to work in your hands, close quote. Later, the revelation would be changed to add an emphasis with the word many, that he had received many revelations through it. The 1835 version said it had, quote, told you many things, close quote. Evidence suggests that Oliver Cowdery learned how to use a divining rod for revelation from his father, who learned it as one of the new Israelites at the turn of the 18th century. In summary, around 1799, Oliver Cowdery's father was involved with a restorationist group that used divining rods to receive revelations and search for treasure. When Joseph Smith Sr. moved from the Palmyra area in 1816, his neighbors observed him using a divining rod. They also reported Joseph Smith Jr.'s use of a seer stone, treasure-seeking, and his recovery of plates of gold. Blastus Hurlbut would later document these stories. In early April 1829, Oliver Cowdery met Joseph Smith and began acting as scribe while Joseph Smith dictated the text of the Book of Mormon through a seer stone. In mid-April, he received revelations having to do with Oliver Cowdery's sprout, or thing of nature. The revelation says Oliver had been told many things through his sprout before meeting Joseph Smith, and that it was God who had made the thing of nature work. Oliver is told that he should try to translate hidden ancient texts through his rod, just as Joseph Smith was translating ancient texts through his treasure-seeking stone. But Oliver's ability to translate never came to fruition. In 1833, the text of the revelation was modified, changing sprout and thing of nature to rod and rod of nature. In 1834, Eber D. Howe published the book Mormonism Unveiled. It contains stories about Joseph Smith between 1816 and 1830 from Joseph Smith's friends, neighbors, and relatives about his career as a treasure seeker. The next year, in 1835, the revelation was published in the Doctrine and Covenants as Section 8. All references to the rod were changed to the gift of Aaron. Howe's book retold the traditional story of Mormonism, including details of treasure seeking and recovering the plates. This motivated Joseph Smith to send elders on missions in Ohio to combat the information from the book. He also began his own history project, telling his story from the standpoint of a prophet restoring ancient scripture and omitting all but one dismissive mention of his treasure-seeking past. When it came time to publish the revelations in 1835 into the Doctrine and Covenants, I believe that Joseph Smith decided it would be best to omit details of Oliver Cowdery's divining rod, an implement widely associated with treasure-seeking. Because of the influential 1834 anti-Mormon book, Joseph Smith put significant effort into distancing himself from his treasure-seeking past and instead emphasized his role as translator and prophet. I believe he wanted to remove any and all reminders of that aspect of his life from public view. So the references to a divining rod were obscured. Today, we have the benefit of historical records allowing us to look back at aspects of Joseph Smith's life. They do not necessarily stand in contradiction to each other, but I believe serve to demonstrate Joseph Smith's evolving role. Joseph translated from village treasure seer, who identified a treasure through his stone and enacted rituals to overpower the guardian treasure guardian, to one who was visited by an angel regarding an ancient buried scripture, which he eventually recovered and translated after yearly instructions from the angel. The plates shifted from a treasure of gold to a sacred ancient text, and Joseph Smith preferred to avoid stories of his treasure-seeking past and instead adopted to tell a story that emphasized his role as a prophet and translator. Smith's history, which he began in 1834, briefly mentions money digging, but seriously understates the importance of that episode in his life. In this story, we see the role of conflict in Mormonism, the cause and effect. Here we see environment shaping doctrine, or in this case, scripture. Thank you.
Well, great. Thank you both. So we have some time for questions. You may line up at this microphone. Please keep your questions and comments brief so that others can participate.
Yes, I've always been fascinated by the fact that Joseph Smith was known as this treasure seeker. As far as I've read and heard, he never had one successful episode of finding treasure. Were people just really gullible back then, more so than we are today, or what's the explanation for that?
I think gullibility continues today.
Get rich quick schemes.
That's my answer.
This question is for Michael. In your introduction, you talked about how it was more important to know that there were redactions that happened rather than tracing back redactions to a specific person. Is that more because it's extremely difficult to figure out who did the redactions, or would we learn if we could, if there were records of it, that it allowed us to find out who redacted it, could it tell us more about why they were redacted?
Yeah, a lot of times the manuscripts don't say why things were changed. It occurred, and usually there's discussion among the church leadership, and then you just find either changes in the text or just new stories are told. So there's nothing that gives us the clear indication of many of the changes.
Yes.
Well, I'll bring up a detail that confirms one of the questions about, did they ever find any treasure? Well, Elizabeth Kane asked Porter Rockwell that very question, and he thought about it for a while, and he said, nope, not until he found the gold Bible. But my question, you know, we've all sat here listening to these preposterous stories, which when you look at them in a non-sacred context are pretty hilarious. So I'd like both great scholars to comment on the potential for comic Mormon history.
Yes, I have found in my studies and talking to both men and women that they really just want to know what the story is. They don't want apologetics because that has nothing to do with history. And I think that that's what the important thing is, that history, we learn things. We don't want to repeat them. And we want to just be known, you know, as far as possible, what occurred. And that's what most people want, especially those that have no agenda, are looking for no converts.
So You know, we have the benefit of having a lot of scientific advancements since that time. That was at the time, people really that was a common belief, and so we can sit back here and kind of chuckle at what seems fairly absurd. But at the time, it really wasn't an absurd idea, and people were always finding mines, ore, and water. People still find water today, supposedly with their divining rods, but scientifically, it just doesn't hold up. And we have the benefit of science to help us weed things out. Regarding the gullibility idea, people today are. I mean, if you look at politics today, there's a lot of dishonesty coming from really both sides, but people lap it up and follow along. And I really believe that we as human beings are gullible. We want to believe in something that has a nice black and white narrative. And we're oftentimes willing to shed our critical analysis and to sacrifice. I mean, we don't like the gray and the complexity. We want something that we can hang on to. And so a lot of times we will sacrifice truth and facts so that we can have this nice, clean narrative to believe on and give us direction and meaning in our life. And I think it's just a common problem in all ages. That's my thought on that.
I'd like to make a comment about the gift of the divining rod. My great-grandfather used that in his lifetime for finding wells. And I think I use it when I go to the DI.
That's great.
So I occasionally have dinner or spend some time with D. Michael Quinn, and we were talking about how hilarious really the later stories are of the church. And we kind of, as a kind of an amateur screenwriter, I thought, well, what would be a really hilarious script? And he said, well, it would have to be Nauvoo 1843, and would only be a movie about that year. And the hilarious last scene would be Joseph declaring his presidency, his running for the president. So my question, since both of you have referenced the Cowdery family, tomorrow in gospel doctrine class, I'm teaching the story of Elijah, who, as you know, appeared to Joseph and Oliver Cowdery in the Kirtland Temple. It's a foundation for section 110. The question I have is that particular revelation was scribed by Warren Cowdery and does not appear in the first person that I saw. And in fact, Warren Cowdery says, they saw. It did not appear until Brigham Young dusted it off in the Utah days. My question would be, it's curious about how important that scripture is to the temple worship in the LDS Church. My question is, what do we know about Warren? Did he have any special spiritual gifts, or how does he fit into your narrative about the Cowdery family?
Thank you for the question. You know, Warren Cowdery, he came from the Freedom Branch as a high priest there, and he arrived in Kirkland in February 1836. And so he probably copied a first-person account into Joseph Smith's history in the third person, just like he copied Joseph Smith's diary into the third person in what's called the 1834-35 history. And so later in years, they changed it to the first person when they're working on the manuscript history of a church. But as far as Elijah, there was no indication that the keys that Elijah brought had anything to do with sealing power. There's no indication of that. So it's pretty important to have these records and anyway.
Next.
I wanted to follow up a little bit about with the first question about the difference in gullibility between people in the 19th century between and now. Like, definitely you had the Fox sisters in Palmyra, you know, and you have psychic friends today. So your point is well taken that people are still gullible. But my question is more about the palatability of the narrative. And, you know, as modern people, we look back and say that's not a palatable narrative. So for me, one of the most surprising things that turned out to be true was what you mentioned in your speech about a black horse with a black carriage with a switch tail. I figured that had to have been made up. But Quinn provided sources on that. Also in the 1826 trial, that was treated as a rumor until Wesley Walters came forward with the missus of that Smith had actually been in court that day. So my question is basically, the latest is the Grant Palmer came forward having said that he held all three of Smith's seer stones, and shortly thereafter we have a poster, not the actual stone, but a poster of physical, you know, in the church history library. So as things shift in as brought forth by historians, people are being asked to, well, that should be palatable. And so when they brought the seer stone forward, I heard many people say that is just, you know, ridiculous on its face, and they left the church over that. Whereas the people who stay in the church can somehow say, oh, that's still palatable to me. Whereas, you know, then going back to the Fox sisters and the psychic friends, where do you draw this distinction between, okay, this is palatable for me versus, yeah, this is just ridiculous. There's some sort of line that has to be crossed over.
Well, right, and the church is faced with a monumental task right now. Previously, before the internet, the narrative presented excluded this because it was tough to deal with. I'm not sure it was a sinister motive, but it was just, well, let's just put in this stuff that helps people believe and have a good testimony. But the internet has forced that, and now all of this information is flooding to the members of the church, and they are left with the church is left with a very difficult task, which is to make this stuff palatable, right? Some of it really stretches credulity to some, and the church is trying very hard. There are books being written by members of the Joseph Smith Papers Project that reinterpret our history and include seer stones, for example, into the narrative and try to make it like, hey, this is okay, and this is in trying to normalize the things that make us want to scratch our heads and try to wonder. So it's going to be really interesting to see how the church is able to do that. There's a lot of people leaving the church or having questions about it because of the information. Can the church present a narrative that includes all of the information and still continue to attract members, or is the church going to kind of start waning in its membership number, its active membership numbers? That's a great question. Subtly, you're saying it's a subtle thing. Yes, it's a gradual, subtle thing. I think they don't want to shock members who don't know about this by just dumping it all at once. So little bits and pieces come out here and there. It's a gradual thing, and they're very carefully trying to slowly, like, change the temperature of the water so nobody notices, you know, and see if they can retain as many people as possible. And I'm really curious to see what the new narrative is going to be that includes all of this information. It's going to be a trick, I think.
Although the essays are quite extensive.
Yeah, and that's part of the new narrative, and that's the new line in the sand, like, before, none of that some of that information would be denied, and now it's admitted to, but it's talked about in a faith-promoting way as possible that also embraces scholarship, and that's the new narrative that they're moving towards. That's how I see it.
Claire, my question is for you about something you mentioned. I've always found it interesting, the evolution from the more folk magic type language to more biblical language, like with the seer stone coming, the Urim and Thummim. But you mentioned the Masonic connection with the term sprout and that connecting to Aaron. And I'd never heard that before. I was curious if you had some recommendations as to where I could learn more about that, because I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, I'm not sure off the top of my head where to read about it. I wonder if Michael Homer's book on two temples, the Mormon temple and the Masonic temple, would probably be a good resource. Okay. I do know if you look up Bernard's Light on Masonry, published in, I think, 1828, and it's online in Google Books, and specifically look up the Royal Arch ritual and read through that narrative. It has very striking parallels, and that's where the sprout is talked about specifically, and that's what I was referring to. In that story, it's an Indiana Jones kind of story where they find the ruins of a temple, they find an underground vault, they go down in there, and there is the Ark of the Covenant. And the Ark of the Covenant contains a sprout of apple from an apple tree, I think, if I remember right. And it contains some other things, including a key that allows them to decipher the sacred name of God that is inscribed on the lid of the Ark of the Covenant. And this is a hidden name that has been kept secret, and Masons have guarded this secret through the eons. And there's a way to translate it with a key. Now, what's curious is that Emma, when she talks about the Urim and Thummim in her book, her narrative, she refers to the Urim and Thummim as a key. And so you have a sprout, and you have a key, and you have revealing the sacred name of God, which Joseph does later in his translation of Adamic language. There's a new revelation revealed in the Joseph Smith papers that where the name of he translates characters and then gives what God is called, what the Son of God is called, angels and men. And curiously, the characters on this side all look like Masonic cipher characters. I don't know. So there's a little bit about that.
Thank you.
I wish we had more time to go into. It's fascinating stuff, I think.
Well, I was going to not say what I'm going to say, but I can't resist. So. I did a lot of research on the New Israelites and the early time in Vermont, and there was a Reverend Laban Clark, and there was an attorney named Barnes Frisbee who interviewed 50 people. Did you go into that research? Because they said that the New Israelites were a front group for counterfeiters, including Justice Winchell, who lived in the home of William Cowdery. And they also said that Joseph Smith Sr. was part of it, and that the Hales lived very nearby Middletown, so they probably were, at least they heard about it, and that that the Cowdereys must have known each other way before 1829 because they were in this New Israelite group. So at least people should consider the possibility that the counterfeiting was, you know, going on, or at least there was, you know, to do with that. And that is maybe why Joseph Smith wanted to distance himself so much from the money digging, because it was involved with the counterfeiting.
Yeah, and this lady has written a book on counterfeiting in Mormonism, is that right?
Yes.
It's available just right across the aisle, which you should stop by and chat with her. Correct. Barnes Frisbee collected a lot of this information, and I do know that a lot of treasure seekers were counterfeiting, and it's kind of like a money laundering, right? You got to legitimize the money that you've counterfeited, and you say, "Oh, we found it with our treasure-seeking rods," right?
Right. They came up with lots of different covers.
And there were other instances of counterfeiting in Mormon history.
Yeah, Nauvoo and
pops up
Kirtland
here and there.
And New York. I mean, it goes to the story. So, yeah, I was fascinated finding out about it. And that's why, you know, divining rods and crossing it out was important. So.
Thanks again to our speakers.